Yes, I'd like to welcome you to the next edition of Crosscut Maker Podcast. It has been, I believe, since February 5th. So it's been over a month. Today is, I'll check my new and improved Fitbit watch. I got to count steps for my insurance premiums. It is March 8th, so it's been over a month since I've done a podcast. And like I've been saying on the last several, I think the last 12 or 13 have been purely eschatological updates, and that's what, Lord willing, I'll continue to do. But I just kind of don't do them every week or every 2 weeks or even every 3 weeks anymore, just kind of whenever enough information gathers that I feel like it's worthy of one. But I also have been doing many other ministries, and there's all kinds of theological podcasts I have. If you'll just look through my history, it's there. And on my websites, crosscutcommentaries.simplesite.com and eoa-indicators.simplesite.com. Those are my two main websites that I do, with the one of them is Broad Theology. The other one's obviously more focused towards end-of-age indicators. And so that's where I'm spending most of my time is actually online, and I'm doing fewer and fewer podcasts. I just kind of do these for the eschatology updates, and like I said, and I always say this each time I do, and this may be my last one that I do. Just depends on whatever I feel like the Lord's will is with these. I try and follow, and I have felt less and less moved to do these. But in the meantime, I will, like I said, most of the detail that I talk about, at least the summary of the detail, is found on the eoa-indicators.simplesite.com website. And that's what I promote and put in front of people. And the goal is that it's not a salvation necessarily, but it is, because I know the gospel is what God uses to save people. And at the end of every podcast, I give a presentation of the gospel, because that's how God saves people. But I'm still trying to plant seeds for what I see coming, what I believe are legitimate biblical indicators that the stage is being set for the tribulation period, that maybe God would use to open a person's heart and spiritual eyes to the gospel if and when the time comes. So that's just been kind of my goal here, is because I genuinely believe with all my heart that we are rapidly approaching the tribulation period, and we are rapidly approaching what would precede the tribulation period, would be the rapture, the glorification and removal of God's true church, all true believers, outside of maybe a few exceptions, would be raptured, would be glorified and caught up in the air to meet Christ in the air. And I do believe that happens before the tribulation period. And if what we see is accurate, if what I'm seeing is actually biblical and it's lining up with the stage setting of the tribulation period, and again, every time I do this, I'm more and more convinced of it, then the signless event of the rapture, which nobody knows the day or the hour, there's no way to know the day, the month, the year, or anything. There's no way to know that. But if that precedes the tribulation period and you see the stage being set for the tribulation period, then you can at least surmise that the rapture would be near. If the tribulation is near and you can see that is not a signless event, there has to be a build-up to the tribulation period. And if you can see that, then what happens before it, which there are no signs for, obviously would kind of carry along with that. All right, but like I said, their last 12, I believe this is number 13 of the eschatology updates, but I'm not sure on that. But if you look back, you can go through those if you want. Some of them are shorter, some of them are longer. I mixed some theology with a couple of them. I thought maybe that would be a good thing to do. But then now, like I said, I've been pretty much focused on the podcast, just doing eschatology and seeing what I'm seeing in reality in the news and how that would line up with the tribulation period. So there's 12 of those previous to this, and we will begin with, let's see here, to get my notepad out. Like I said, the last one I did was on February 5th, And so since then, I just kind of take notes as things come along. And one of the big things that have been happening since that time is a massive increase in earthquakes. There have been pretty significant increase in earthquakes over the past decades and years, and the things seem to be increasing. But over the past month, there have been several large earthquakes. And I'm going to pull up my earthquake app here, see how far back that scrolls. But a lot of the main focus of that has been what is right off the coast of New Zealand, called the Kermadec Islands region, and they have had unbelievable amounts of earthquakes. I'm just scrolling back here. Now, the big ones that happened there, yeah, I mean, I'm talking like 30 or 40. This app tracks ones that are 5.5 and over. And what we had, let's see here, this would have been on March, looks like they began on March 3rd, and there was a 7.3, you had a 7.4, you had a 8.1 was the biggest one on the Richter scale, and then you've had multiple 6s and 5.5s and 6s. But you, so you had 1.8 and a couple in the 7s. Those are large earthquakes. And then you have had massive amounts of pretty significant earthquakes in that same region. And there have been other ones. There was one in off of Greece, 6.3, and then this goes back to March 2nd. But even prior to that, there was another big one somewhere that I can't remember. I think it might have been off the coast of off the coast of Japan, and they actually fired a tsunami warning for that as well. And I think, if I remember right, again, this thing goes back to March 2nd. It was before that. But there's been the really uptick in earthquake activity since our last podcast. And of course, that is one of the very clear signs that Jesus talked about in Mark 13, Luke 21, and Matthew 24 about increases in earthquakes. And so that has been something that is of noteworthy. And the one you probably heard about was the 8.1 on off the coast of New Zealand, because that was pretty much major news on all the national channels. All right. And, okay, Middle East instability. Now, of course, Biden has been president now since January 20th, and that has been more than, almost 2 months now he's been president. And there have, obviously, which we kind of anticipated, that he would shift his Middle East policy pretty significantly compared to Donald Trump. And he has. And a lot of it is focused, everything over there right now is focused upon Iran. And the Biden administration has indicated from the get-go that they are seeking to re-enter what is called the JCPOA nuclear agreement made in 2015. That Donald Trump wiped out. He just pulled the United States out of that agreement, and that Biden and his administration would seek to re-enter that and maybe change some of the stipulations. But of course, Iran, they're demanding that the United States lift all the sanctions first, the economic sanctions on them first, and the United States is demanding that Iran, because they never were under the regulations that were in that agreement, that they've always been secretly going beyond those limits that were set for them. And of course, now they're openly doing it, to the point where they have just about everybody worried, knowing that they're swiftly making their way to the capacity to have a nuclear weapon. So you have kind of the stalemate between the United States and Iran when it comes to those two countries, but then there's other countries trying to get things involved and whatnot. But in the meantime, Iran is being pretty aggressive. Their proxies had fired some rockets several times into Iraq, on the Iraq-Syria border, and a couple of those did some damage to some United States military bases. And there was one civilian American contractor who was killed. And it kind of put Biden into a position where he had to respond, and he did. They launched a couple of airstrikes in Syria, going after these proxies, but they were very, very limited, very measured. And you could tell that his he just, in my opinion, felt like he needed to do something to save face, that he didn't look like they were just getting pushed over. But of course, those measured responses didn't really cause anything, any fear in the eyes of Iran's government, because they basically have done the same thing. They fired more rockets into those same areas a couple days ago. And so you have this, this basically just kind of a stalemate. And the other ingredients over there are Israel, obviously, has stated multiple times that they are not going to allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon, and that if they have to go alone and actually attack Iran with a significant military attack, they will do that. And you can't blame them for that, because they recognize that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, then they obviously would love to fly it into Israel and destroy them. But if not, even if they didn't do that, they would have what is, you know, they'd have a nuclear deterrent where they could increase their activities of their terrorist proxies, and they would have a weapon, you know, a weapon of not just the physical weapon of it, but the intimidation of having a nuclear weapon to prevent responses to their activities. And so they would have what is called a nuclear deterrent, where they would be able to be more aggressive because they would have a nuclear, they could say, hey, we have a nuclear weapon, who knows what we'll do with it. And if one nuclear weapon is detonated anywhere, you know, that's really, really horrific, not just for where it hits and where it explodes, but also, you know, there's going to be a response to it. There has to be a response to it. That's why you just, you know, you get one of them going, and then you're going to have multiples, and then before you know it, you have catastrophic situation going on there. And so that's why Israel is not going to let Iran get a nuclear weapon. But that would be a very destabilizing action as well, as we know, if Israel did attack Iran directly and militarily. Now, you know, right now they are at war proxily through their proxies. That is, that Iran attacks Israel through their proxies in Lebanon and Syria and I think it's in Libya, south of Israel. They have these proxies that do their dirty work, but it's not designated to the country of Iran. You know, their military, it's through them. And then Israel, what they do is they respond by going after the proxies. They don't directly, even though they know that it's Iran who is behind these attacks, that they don't directly attack Iran. That what they do is they go after the proxies that are doing the dirty work for Iran. So you don't have direct military confrontation between Iran and Israel, but if Israel is forced to, if there's two choices between allowing Iran to get a nuclear weapon or attacking them directly and militarily, Israel has said that they will go with the second option there. But again, that would be destabilizing. Nobody wants that, and Israel doesn't want that, but if it comes to it. So that's why there's a lot of panic involved, and, you know, the intensity involved in trying to solve this Iranian nuclear solution, because of the imminency of an Israeli attack, which would change a lot of things. All right, but also you have these other moderate Arab nations who have made the Abraham Accords with Israel, including UAE, Morocco, and Sudan, and of course Saudi Arabia hasn't officially normalized with them, but they are kind of in a lot of relations with Israel. And they have, and that is based upon, we've talked about this many times before, that's based upon, those Abraham Accords are a reaction to Iran. They're more, those moderate Arab nations that are making normalization deals with Israel and the others who might join in are doing it because they're much more afraid of Iran and their danger than they are of Israel's danger. And so it's kind of like enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of deal, and that's what I think is the motivation behind a lot of these normalization agreements. And so you have that there. But then the Palestinians have been the ones left out, and again, another shift in U.S. policy has been that they are eagerly seeking to bring the Palestinians back in to the agreements. And that, again, we talked about last time, where they're actually, you know, the Palestinians, well, first off, they're going to have elections. We're going to get to the elections here in a little bit. But they are calling for kind of a global Peace, Mideast Peace Summit from the United Nations to kind of bring in everything together. And of course, that would be, in my opinion, something that would be prophetically significant if that were to occur. Just the fact that it's being talked about is prophetically significant. So we have a shift in U.S. policy, pretty major shift in U.S. policy in the Middle East. And they're not dissolving the Abraham Accords, but they're certainly not supporting them, the Biden administration. They're seeking basically to undo everything Donald Trump did. Even if, in my opinion, you know, that you have something that was productive. That just the fact that Trump had his fingerprints on it automatically means the Biden administration is going to do whatever they can, directly or indirectly, to diminish that. And also, the accusation of back-channeling has come to the forefront. It was spoken about, I think, three weeks ago or so. And what that means is that the Trump administration accused, and I remember hearing about this, about midway through the Trump administration, that John Kerry and some other political figures of the Obama administration were having back-channel negotiations with Iran and with other Middle East countries over there. And they were basically saying, just hold on. We know Trump's doing a whole lot of different things from what we were doing in the Obama administration, but wait till we get back in charge, and we're going to go back to the way things were, and we'll build on what the direction we were going during the Obama administration. And there, of course, that's not appropriate for former political, office holders to be undermining the current administration through what a back channel. Negotiations, presuming on a future change in administration. And that I'd heard that during, somebody had mentioned to me in passing that this was going on, and kind of piqued my interest a little bit. But then now it's really kind of came to the forefront that it's John Kerry specifically was doing a lot of this back channel negotiating with Iran. Again, that's undermining the Trump administration at that time. But did it give them an advantage to kind of shift things back a little more quickly now that Biden has been elected? And he is the third term of Obama, He is doing pretty much, he's got all the people from the Obama administration, and a lot of people are just recognizing that a couple things, sadly, is that his health has not gotten any better, nor will it. President Biden is not intellectually the same that he was 4 years ago when he was, or a little bit more than 4 years ago when he was vice president. I think everybody recognizes that. Now, how much of the decisions he's actually making, I don't know. But you can tell he's definitely being protected. He has not had any press conferences, any interactive press conferences where he has to receive questions on the spot. And they've even the liberal mainstream media has begun to question how come that has not occurred yet in this amount of time that he's been president. And I think the answer is pretty clear. He wouldn't be capable of doing that. He struggles enough to read off a teleprompter. And again, my heart goes out to him. As a Christian person, we're called biblically to pray for our leaders. But on top of that, President Biden is lost. He's a devout Roman Catholic, which is a false religious system. You can definitely tell by his life and his policies that he's not a Christian. And so the worst case scenario for him would be to die and face the eternal wrath of God for his sins, which is what would happen if he took his last breath right now. So that's my top concern for anybody who is elderly. And again, it's not easy to watch him struggle with just communicating, and it's distressing a little bit that he's the most powerful person in the world, and appears to be struggling this way intellectually. So there's all kinds of concerns involved in that, and then we've heard that Kamala Harris is doing a lot of the negotiations with other world leaders on the phone, and you can understand why that would be, because she's coherent and he's probably not able to have those conversations. When a lot of people were getting on Biden about why he had not called Netanyahu for quite a while, he ended up doing that. Probably a very brief, controlled conversation. is because I don't think he wants to engage, interact with people who, especially who might oppose something he's standing for, because I don't think he's intellectually capable of interacting right now with you know, that's just seems like the reality of it. And so the idea is, who's in charge of the presidency? And again, nobody knows for sure, but there has been theories and speculations about there, you know, being a group of liberal, you know, just the very powerful people in the Democratic Party who are making the decisions, and he's just kind of a puppet right now. And that may be true, may not be true. I don't believe he's to the point where he can't, you know, that he's just completely submissive to a group of people and he's just doing whatever they want. I think he has a say in the matter, but I think he probably understands that he is limited in what he can do and he needs the help of other people. So it's hard to know who behind the scenes is really making the decisions, but it's at least possible that people other than President Biden are making all the decision, and he is just kind of going along and announcing what is being decided on. You know, who knows how much pull Kamala Harris has? Who knows how much pull President Obama has? Who knows how much pull his cabinet has, you know, in making these decisions? But it definitely is a unique situation with President Biden because of his health, and I worry about his health. And like I said, spiritually mainly, but also physically, that it would not be good for this country, in my opinion, for him, something to happen to him, and Kamala Harris would have to take over. It would probably be worse. But politically, they're both, I mean, what he's doing now with these endless executive orders is maddening to observe. And of course, I would disagree with almost every single thing he's done when it comes to his policies. But I try to stay away from the political angles of things as much as I can. But that is an issue of Biden's competency. All right, yes, and we do have multiple elections coming up in the Middle East. Obviously in Israel, I think it's on March 23rd. It's definitely towards the end of March, they're going to have their fourth round of elections in 2 years, which is incredible. That's very unusual. And of course, Netanyahu's running, and then there's a couple other options there. And you know, it seems like every time I hear the updates on who's leading or who has the advantage, it goes back and forth between Netanyahu and somebody else. My thought has been and continues to be anticipating that we are so close to the tribulation period, which in the tribulation period would begin with a 7-year peace agreement involving Israel and the Antichrist. And part of that deal, I believe, would have to be the surrender of your military capacity to defend yourself. I think that's scriptural. I think the Ezekiel 38-39 invasion happens in the tribulation period, and it appears that they are defenseless when that happens, and that they are unwalled. They're, and I think part of that agreement that the Antichrist makes with them is that he takes responsibility for their security. And I have never thought that Benjamin Netanyahu has the personality or the politics that would go along with that. I just, you know, again, I understand spiritual deception, and I don't believe Netanyahu. There's been some people say that he's a Christian, but I've never seen anything to tell me that he believes that Jesus Christ is God or that he's the Jewish Messiah or anything. And he seems to be very proud, and he's obviously got some corruption charges and everything else. But I just have never, I don't see any evidence that he's a true Christian. So could he be spiritually deceived? Of course he could. God could blind him in a lot of ways where I could say, well, you know, I don't see him making that kind of a commitment or that kind of a compact with the Antichrist. But given the right situation, any person lost in their sin will do just about anything. And so who knows what that environment would be like. So it's theoretically possible that he could and would. But I just have thought, somehow he's got to get out of there, and he keeps winning elections, so he hasn't gotten out of there. And again, on a political level, I'm conservative, and I agree with the politics of Trump. Politics, I agree with the politics of Netanyahu. I think he's the best prime minister for Israel politically, militarily, economically. But obviously spiritually, I'm not talking about that. But But it's going to be close. It's going to be a very close election. But I've always thought that he would not be the one to make the agreement with the Antichrist. And so I've always anticipated that he would lose. But he hadn't lost yet. But there's another election coming up in a couple weeks, and we'll see what happens on that. Like I said, it seems very close. And he's got some advantages. The vaccines, they have been very, very, like the world standard when it comes to getting their people vaccinated in Israel. And that has been really helped him a lot because they're opening up now. Of course, they're doing kind of like a green pass thing where, you know, if you get vaccinated, you get a pass and you can do certain things. If you're not vaccinated, then you can't do certain things. And there's all kinds of potential prophetic things about that. But, that's really not an issue. But also, on the negative, he's got corruption charges. A lot of people have been upset with his lockdowns, and so it seems like right now is a 50-50 thing proposition. But my guess would be he will lose if we are close to the tribulation period. But that's just a guess based upon not seeing him as the personality who would make an agreement with the Antichrist. But as we mentioned earlier, this is another election. The Palestinians have not had one for, if I remember right, like 2010. It's been a while since they've had any kind of elections. And I really don't know much about the whole political environment there. Obviously, we know Mahmoud Abbas is elderly. He's a little bit older. He's a little bit harder to deal with when it comes to Israel, or because he's had no advancement, according to what he's done. The only reason things are advancing now in the Middle East peace-wise is because I believe they've been kind of removed from any influence of stopping it, as we've talked about before. But I think the other alternative is Hamas, and they're a terrorist organization, so I don't know how much they would be willing to negotiate either. So it's really, I don't know if that would have any significance if it went one way or the other. But it certainly is more instability in the Middle East, especially with a group of people that are, right at the core of the Middle East peace process. They are the turning point, in my opinion. I think one of the very final pieces of the Antichrist covenant that he makes with Israel is he is somehow able to bring in the Palestinians. That's the one piece that doesn't seem likely right now. And again, I think the Third Temple will be part of that deal as well. So we'll see how those elections go. But again, my thought has been that Netanyahu would not be the one to make the agreement. And so I would anticipate that he would lose, but that really doesn't necessarily, if he wins, doesn't necessarily mean anything at all either. All right, and then they also had the Munich Security Conference, and I watched some of that until my head got tired, and it was more of the same global unity messages. But the big difference is Biden and his agreement with it. So what you had last year and the previous years during Trump's administration is Trump was a nationalist. He was an America first, which I believe is the right way to do it. Is nations, not global governance. I don't believe that's the way that God intended things. That we have balance of power by having nations. And so Trump was a nationalist, and so he didn't really participate in a whole lot of these global, everybody was just come together kind of conferences. But now Biden is in the office, the most powerful office in the world, and he is a globalist, no doubt about it. He affirmed that absolutely and directly, saying America's back. America's back. We're going to be part of this whole global deal now. And so that was interesting. He actually I guess that the President of the United States had not spoken at that conference in quite a while. It was the first time in a long time. And I listened to as much as I could. But again, you can pretty much, when you get to these United Nations conferences or the Munich conference or any of these global world leader conferences, you can pretty much press play and you'll hear, we have global problems, we need global solutions. We all need to come together. So that's what's going to happen by the time the tribulation period starts, we will have a global governing system and the Antichrist ultimately takes over. So there's no surprise in that. And again, I don't see this freight train stopping, especially with the election of Biden. It has put the fuel and the gas pedal full blast towards globalism, global governance. And also, there seems to be a potential unification of United States and Europe sprouting. There's this Munich Security Conference, obviously, was focused on Europe and other places, but there definitely seems to be talks between Europe and the United States that weren't there during the Trump administration. And I bring this up because I've done an essay, which is on crosscutcommentaries.civilsite.com. It talks about has the future revived Roman Empire of the Tribulation period already been revived? And my answer is yes. And my answer is that we are it. The United States is the revived Roman Empire that is taken over by the Antichrist during the Tribulation period. You know, you can go to that website, and I think it's under essays. I'm pretty sure it's under essays, but it might be under lessons. I got two sections there, lessons and essays and tracks, but it's either, I think it's under essays, and it says, you know, it's under eschatological estimations, has the future Roman Empire, and you can see it. It's very brief. It's a one-page deal, and it just kind of summarizes why I believe the United States of America is the revived Roman Empire of the Tribulation period. But I've also thought that it's possible, if not likely, that we would unify, because we sprouted out of the Roman Empire that destroyed, and this goes to Daniel chapter 9, verse 26, I believe, where it talks about the people of the prince who is to come, who levels Israel, and that's 70 AD, that's the Roman Empire, clearly. And so the Antichrist comes out of a revived Roman Empire, and how and I'll show a brief map there, how we have actually come out of that empire. We came from, you know, came over here to America. The start of this country came from that area that was actually part of that Roman government. Anyway, then I go through the other arguments, like we are the most powerful country in the history of the world. I'm not quite sure how we could be left out of the empire genealogy, quote unquote, or, you know, just per se, of global empires without being mentioned there. So I think we are. I think we're just the reemergence of the Roman Empire. Yet I do think that it's possible, like I said, if not likely, that we would, the United States would form some kind of a coalition with Europe. And that would be kind of the, somehow mixed among there would be that that Western alliance that the Antichrist comes to power through. And so I believe that the Antichrist does not have to necessarily come from Europe. He could come from the United States. But we could be separate from Europe at that time. We could just be the revived Roman Empire, and we don't reunite with Europe in a military fashion at the beginning of the Tribulation period, but I would tend to think that we are. And so, circling back, I think that it's significant here that there does appear to be, with Biden, a desire to reunite. See, his political philosophies, along with Obama's, are similar to Europe's political philosophies. I don't agree with those. And again, you'd have Trump kind of interrupt those two administrations there. But now that Biden's back in, and it appears that there is at least a potential unification with the United States and Europe. And, you know, how that ties into a global government, a one-world government, the coalition of 10 that begins, the Antichrist comes from a group of 10, or he's a newcomer, that it's not part of the initial 10, and how all that ties in is difficult to understand. But my thoughts have been, for a while now, is again that I do believe the United States is the revived Roman Empire, or at least a significant part of it. We don't get wiped out. A lot of people think, well, America's not in the eschatology of the Bible, and it's true. It's not named, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we get wiped out. It just means that we don't defend Israel at that time. But I believe that we are actually in the Bible. It's just we're not directly stated as a country. We are just the revived Roman Empire that Antichrist takes over. So we'll see how all that shakes out, but you definitely see with Biden coming in, you have a globalist ambition, you have a desire to unify with European countries there, and you've just got all of the restraints on a human level that the Trump administration offered to those the roadblocks to what they wanted to do during the Obama administration, and what they want to do now is removed. All right. Now, also, we've had significant weather events. It seems like those are happening all the time. And the big one since we last had a podcast was the icing event of Texas. There was a big, several snowstorms. I do lawn care, and I actually have a walk-behind snowblower, and so I haven't used it in 3 years, and so, but I actually got to use it, because we got pretty, praise the Lord, we got some ice, but we were right in the kind of the deadly zone of getting all our power knocked out there for a while, but then it dropped a little south of us, and then, so, but we got ice, and we got snow, we got enough to where I worked for a couple weeks there doing that, and I was thankful for that, because I had bought the snowblower back in 2016, I believe, or maybe 2015, and I used it like one day that year, one day the next year, and then I hadn't used it since, and I hadn't had it even kind of paid off yet, and so I thought one more day I'd pay it off, and I actually worked 3 or 4 days, so I'm thankful to the Lord to be able to do some work there. So we experienced some of the effects of that, but man, we were nothing compared to what they got down there. Obviously, I'm sure you've heard where they got iced out, and all the power was overloaded, and their pipes were exploding. They just weren't prepared for the ice and the cold that happened there. And, man, it was just, your heart went out to those people down there. And they're still struggling, I think, getting their water back on at this point. And everything's warmed up and everything. But that was certainly a real tough thing. So aside from the earthquakes, you've had, you know, significant weather events. And that was the most significant. But at the bottom line, any weather event related to birth pangs, and I believe these are unusual. And these are indicators. These are increasing birth pangs of warnings to the world that things are, you know, the earthquakes and the storms and the hurricanes last year that were overwhelming, and the just nonstop wildfires and the nonstop weather events are God's gracious warnings that they're birth pangs approaching the tribulation, in my opinion. But of course, the world and the left will, you know, any weather related birth pang is just attributed to no longer climate change, but now it's a climate crisis. First, it was global warming, but of course that doesn't work out when you have an ice storm and you have sub-zero weather in Texas, and so the problem is cold, extreme cold. So global warming doesn't work at that point. It hadn't worked for quite a while, and so now it's, of course, it's been for several years, climate change. So of course climate changes, but I've written a brief essay on that, is on the same website, talk about the biblical problems with climate change, and there are many. It's not a biblical concept, but regardless. But we know now, I've noticed that their language is no longer climate change, but climate crisis. Everything's climate crisis. And so the two unifying forces for globalism, this is what the forces that are being utilized to bring the world together, is coronavirus, obviously. We got a world problem here. We got a world solution, vaccine. So we need world cooperation. So everybody needs to come together. There's one unifying force of globalism, and the other is climate change. Now, everybody, especially now that the Biden administration's in, they immediately rejoined the Paris climate deal, and they just said, all right, we're all in for this great reset. We're all in for these extreme radical climate laws, and I mean, they would devastate people, but people might have to experience that themselves. I'm not going to go into the whole climate change debate right now, but my point here is that is a unifying. So every time an extreme weather event happens, all it does is, you know, instead of, I believe the proper response would be, oh, God might be trying to get our attention here that we've increased in wickedness, especially in our country. And, you know, all the laws we're passing and all the babies that are being slaughtered in the womb and the disregard for biblical marriage anymore, even on a political level. I couldn't be anything like iniquity that we're being judged for, but no, it's just, we are abusing Mother Nature, and she's angry about that, and so we just need to adjust our climate change laws. Of course, you can hopefully sense the mockery in my voice on that, even though I'm not trying to be sarcastic or condescending, but I do not agree, obviously, with climate change. But so anytime you see the hurricanes last year, the wildfires, the, you know, it's just another push towards, hey, we need climate change laws. And the whole, obviously, you know, if you really believe climate change, and I don't, but if you do, yeah, you would have to get the whole world on board if you really want to make an impact. You can't just have half the countries, you know, obeying these laws that you think will clean up the planet and solve all the problems, and the other half are not. That's not going to work, because their pollution is going to carry over. And so, and they would be probably more in demand for products and blah, blah, blah. And so they would just increase their pollution. So you would have to have a world agreement. I see the idea behind that. But of course, I don't believe in the philosophy behind it. But there, again, now, especially with Trump gone, who resisted that, you have a lot of people on board for this climate change thing. So again, that's a push towards globalism. And it's going to happen one way or the other. But here's the thing. Here's what I'll say. Is that we see all of these precursors. We see all this build up to the tribulation period. And you see it on a human level. And part of it is aggravating to watch. But you have to pull back. Pull your heart up and realize God's in control. God is sovereign over these activities. And he's advancing it according to his will. And these things, if we are close to the tribulation period, they are going to happen. They're going to, God's going to allow this setup to happen. But ultimately, we know the end is about the return of Christ. And so we have to, I have to constantly not get too big. That's why I really try to avoid doing a whole lot of the what I'm doing here, because it can be easy to get sucked down and get frustrated about climate change and all these other things that you just know on a human level are going to destroy lives. And the whole, you know, the Equality Act they're trying to pass and trying to force it to where women's sports has to allow men who claim to be men to participate in. They can use the bathrooms of girls at school. I mean, it's overwhelming to think about those things. So I gotta pull back and say, okay, Lord's in charge, Lord's in control, and this is under, you know, this is all directed and ultimately ends in the return of Jesus Christ, which is the best news. So I try not to get too overwhelmed with these things, even though they appear to be the ball on these things are not rolling. So it's like half very exciting and encouraging, because knowing that we, not knowing for sure, but really highly believe it, to the point of whatever is just short of knowing that we're close to the tribulation period is where I'm at. That's exciting to know that the biblical prophecy, but you also recognize on the human level the difficulty that brings the buildup alone, but let alone the tribulation period itself. So, but that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, is to warn people, to see what I'm seeing, to warn them that what is very likely to come. And again, okay, this is what I was trying to think. I brought this up for a reason. But this is my whole point I just forgot about. What they don't see, all of this globalistic endeavors and we'll get to the Pope's visit here to Iraq and the unification of the religions and all these things. And you see this build-up to the tribulation period happening providentially on a human level. Okay, it's providential and it's in, I would say, natural. Just natural means of people doing what people do to set the stage for the tribulation period. What they don't see is the rapture of the church. There's the supernatural accelerant to this situation we have now that changes it all, throws it all into it is what creates the environment that the Antichrist immediately. I mean, I don't think there's going to be. The rapture is not the day of the tribulation beginning. The tribulation period begins with a 7-year deal involving Israel. 7-year peace deal involving Israel. I repeat that frequently because I want people to have it in their head. 7-year peace deal involving Israel. There's the tribulation period. You're in it, and when that happens. The rapture, I believe, precedes that. But I don't believe it's on the day of that. It could be. Now, if God ordained it to where he raptures the church and that peace deal is signed the same day, well, then that same day, the tribulation period and the rapture would happen on the same day. But I tend to think it happens before, but not the same day, but not very much before. My point is that I think rapture happens, and in my opinion, within months at the most. The way things are setting up now, you know, it almost looks like it's going to happen without the rapture. But I think the rapture will be the accelerant that closes all the deals, brings in the third temple, all these other things that just everything just falls into place. But they don't see that coming. Obviously, unbelievers are not going to believe in a rapture. So they don't see that coming. They just see their climate change laws and, hey, we can get world control through this, and hey, the vaccine and coronavirus is an opportunity to take world control through this, and we're just going to kind of plug along and do our thing. And they're thinking long term, probably. They're probably not thinking in the next immediate future they're going to have everything they want. They're not going to have their global government that they want, but they are, in my opinion, they are going to have the global government they want far faster than they think, because the accelerant they don't see is the rapture of the church. They're planning outside of God's intervention. that'll be a direct intervention, supernatural intervention of God. And so they don't see that. So I factored that in. And that's why, you know, it's like I see these things almost occurring on a human providential level to build up to the tribulation period, happening without that supernatural accelerant, which means, in my opinion, we're closer than ever. And then that would create the environment that the Antichrist takes advantage of. All right. So a couple more points here. I heard something, and some of this stuff is, I'm not 100% sure on whether I, but the guy that I listen to on some of these things is trustworthy on some other things. But some things that I just think, I'm not sure, but anyway. So I'll just say I heard. You can verify this on your own if you want. There's a Judean mountain school. Now, again, we're talking about the third temple here. We do know that there's already been many utensils made. We do know they're trying to have the red heifer, the pure red heifer where they can sacrifice and have the ashes that they need to enter into the third temple. Might already have that. They might have already sacrificed that. We don't know. There's a lot of talk about that in the fall, and we never heard whether that the candidates came to be pure enough. And you think that if it were not, you would have heard. Because, sorry we don't have it, but I have always understood that if they do get one, they're going to keep it quiet. At least until they sacrifice it. Because they don't want to they want to put it in danger. Because people, obviously Arab countries or anybody who's aggressive towards Israel would not want to let them get anything that would advance their passion for the third temple. But anyway, that's part of that issue. And they have had animal sacrifices on altars outside of the temple wall, and there's just a serious significant effort now to get a third temple. But anyway, on that note, I did hear that there's a Judean mountain school training Levites, tribe of Levi, in holy tongues, and there was the pre-Babylonian language, they believe. Again, I don't believe anything. I don't think you're right on the third temple shouldn't be built anyway, because Christ fulfilled all those things. So all that's sinful. So I'm not endorsing this. And of course, this is even more outrageous in my mind, but the reality that is happening, so that they're training them in what they believe is the original language of Adam and Eve, and again, it's to prepare them for the third temple. And here's the thing, that will unify the world. And I've said this many times, that third temple is not going to be a Jewish temple. It's going to be a Jewish temple, but it's going to be more than a Jewish temple. It's going to be an unbelief. They're going to be sacrificing animals sinfully for the forgiveness of sins, which Christ fulfilled. And their concept is not to separate themselves from the world, other world religions. It's going to be to unify the world in their religions. And so I believe the third temple is just going to roll that Judaism, and the third temple will be part of the one world religion of the first half of the tribulation period. So they're not going to be set apart from these other things. But you see that with this, if this is true, that they are training these in this universal language that is preparing for a unifying temple on the Temple Mount, well, that would fit absolutely perfectly into the whole the roll-in of the false religion, the false one-world religion, and the false temple that will be built. It will be built. Again, as I mentioned earlier, I believe that's going to be part of one of the very closing arguments, or the sealing of the deals for Israel, is that they're going to get their third temple, and that I believe in that tribulation triggering 7-year deal. And the Palestinians, who knows what they'll get to bring them in, but they'll be brought in. Everybody will be brought in. Everybody will think that everything's been solved. And the world religions will be unified, and again, by that time, I believe the Christians will be out of there, and they're gone. The troublemakers are gone. We can unify, and false religions will unify. No doubt about that. But we'll see how that goes. But I did hear that, and I thought that was significant enough to mention. And finally, yes, the Pope is back at it. I've said this from the beginning, that the false prophet, also known as the second beast of Revelation 13. Now, we don't know. Again, I don't put names to people. I really try not to. I used to do that a little more. I speculate on, where the Antichrist will come from and things. But I typically avoid name calling now, and including the false prophet. So I don't know. I certainly would not say that, Pope Francis is the false prophet. Because I don't know that for sure. The fact that he's elderly and and his health is waning would make me wonder if he would be able to survive physically long enough to do that. I don't know. But he certainly fits the role. And I've heard it said that he is certainly auditioning and he's putting in his resume for the office of false prophet, because the false prophet unifies the world into a one world religion. And just Google what he's doing over the past, ever since he's taken office. But even more so now, he's increasing his ecumenical activity, and he is bent on unifying Islam and Judaism and Christianity, so-called. And Catholicism is not Christian. He does not represent me. But the false Christianity he does represent. And so he's trying to, of course he wouldn't say that, but he's trying to unify the three Abrahamic faiths, which are Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. And it goes back to Abraham. The Jews would believe, and the Christians both would believe, that the Muslim, you know, that Isaac, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was the genetical line that God used. Genetic chosen people, or chosen nation, that Abraham, and again, Christians would agree, that God's ethnic chosen people is Israel, nation of Israel. And that was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Arab nations would believe that Abraham, but no, through Ishmael is God's chosen ethnic people. And so you have those three major faiths that originate in Abraham. And of course, the Pope was very careful not to mention Isaac, and he certainly didn't mention Jesus. He didn't mention his name one time, I believe, in this trip to Iraq. And he's the supposed head of Christianity, and you go to somewhere for 3 days and try and unify world religion, and you just don't even mention Jesus Christ. Gee, I don't know, maybe he's not the head of the church, just saying. But so he visited Iraq to engage in even more interreligious dialogue, said interreligious prayers, and he is serious about unifying, and he's probably, again, if we are approaching the tribulation period, whether or not he is the false prophet or not, he definitely is a force in creating this one world religion. Whether somebody else takes over the office of false prophet in the tribulation period, that's to be seen. But he certainly fits the bill for attempting to bring about world unification of religions. He's even trying to bring in atheists. You know, atheists can be saved, you know, if you just try and follow your conscience and do what's right. And so he's just basically a universalist. Everybody's okay, let's all reunite. And that fits again with the one world religion of the tribulation period. And of course, he visits Babylon. He visits Ur of Chaldees, where Abraham's birthplace, trying to unite the Abrahamic faiths, not mentioning Isaac, not mentioning Jesus, because he's trying to unite. And so everybody just, we all agree on Abraham. Islam will agree on them, Jews will agree on them, Christians would agree on them, so-called. Of course, we wouldn't. But, not just leaving it there. So that's what he was involved in trying to do. And then he visited Babylon, which of course is all kinds of prophetic significance to that name. With Revelation chapter 17, you have, I believe, political Babylon, you have religious Babylon in the tribulation period, you have the globalist one world government, and you have the global, which would be political Babylon, mystery Babylon would be the one world false religion that I believe Pope Francis is forming right under our own, right in front of us right now. And I tweeted this morning that I kind of made a little rolling eyes joke, like, no, nothing prophetically significant about the Pope going to Babylon to unify the world's religions, you know, nothing potentially prophetic about that. And I had the eye roll emoji, which is staggering to me. Again, I talk about this just about every time I do a podcast. I have to guard myself from getting too overly emotional about all this stuff, because a lot of this is on a human level. You can get upset, you can get rejoiced, you know, just, man, it's tough, because I'm convinced we're very close. The time is running out, and when the birth pangs began, they don't go backwards, they go forwards, and they increase in speed and intensity, and that means time is running shorter and shorter than maybe I even understand. But anyway, so there is my latest prophecy, I guess you'd call it a prophecy update, I like to call it eschatological update. And so today is March 8th, 2021, and Lord willing, it might be my last. Or I might do one in a week, or I might do one in a month, or I might do one in a couple months. Who knows? I just pay attention to what's going on. And I try to do one whenever I accumulate enough to where I think it's worth doing. And I thought today's was. But I always close out our updates with the gospel presentation, because that's the most important thing. And you're believing, you know, hearing about these prophetic events and even watching them occur. Let's say I'm right on some of these things, especially, like I said, the 7-year peace agreement involving Israel. You see it happen. It's not necessarily going to convert you. You need the recognizing eschatological events and even being warned about them and even seeing them physically occur right in front of you doesn't cause saving faith in Christ. As we know, when Christ was here, he did many, 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 many miracles. Many miracles. I mean, they said John said there wouldn't be enough books to record what he did supernaturally. But most people died in their sins in his first advent. Most people, there were very few people left after he ascended. There's 120 in the upper room. So just knowing something about how the end times would work and actually observing it occur, you won't be able to say, okay, now I'm going to see if the 7-year peace agreement he's talking about occurs. And when that occurs, well, then I'll believe. That's not how salvation works. Salvation works by... Today is the day of salvation. Today is, every day is an urgent day. You know, the tribulation period will be a time when whoever, all the people of the world who enter the tribulation period, by the time of Christ's return, there's not going to be many left physically. It's going to be devastation. There are billions of people dying at one time, multiple times in the tribulation period. Mass carnage. So there's no way to even think that you would survive for who knows how long. On top of that, you might not make it through today. Nobody knows their last day. So the gospel is the important thing. Believing and becoming a Christian today is the important thing. And so I'll read my biblical gospel tract, and then we'll close the podcast. Since the time may be near to the return of God incarnate Jesus Christ, here's a true biblical gospel presentation in 30 seconds. One day we will all face the one true and living holy God. You need to have your sins forgiven and be reconciled to him before that occurs. So salvation is about the forgiveness of sins and reconciliation to God. That's what it's about. It's not about getting money. It's not about God making you happy. It's not about God cleaning up your alcohol problem. It's not about God straightening out your marriage. It's about the forgiveness of sins that you need. Because what sends a person to hell are unforgiven sins. In God's great love, he has mercifully made a way. That only happens biblically by repentance, confessing your sinfulness and hopelessness from your heart to God, and faith, believing the gospel. What is the gospel, you ask? Well, I'm glad you asked, because I'll give you the answer. That is who Jesus Christ is, the person and work of Jesus Christ. The person is he's truly man and he's truly God. You got to believe he is God, you got to believe he's man, and you trust only in his redemptive work. He lived without sin, he died on a cross for the sins of sinners, and he was raised from the dead. That's his perfect, finished, redemptive work. And you put your hope in what he's done. You put your hope in his sinless life, in his death for sins, in his resurrection for your salvation alone. Nothing you bring. You don't bring your own moral ability to obey what you think are God's laws. You don't put any hope in your baptism. You don't put any hope in any religious ceremonial duty like baptism or communion or anything else, or going to church on Sunday or church membership. You can put no hope in that, because that won't save you. You could be a churchgoer, get baptized 80,000 times throughout your life, and you could die in your sins if you don't truly believe. If you have not genuinely repented, that is, you have not been broken over your sin. If you don't think you need a Savior, you won't receive one into your heart. You cannot receive a Savior until you know you need one. If you genuinely do this, you will be instantly and permanently covered by the righteousness of Christ. So when somebody gets genuinely converted, they are imputed or covered, accounted, the righteous, the perfect obedience of the sinless life we just talked about is given to you, it's credited to you, permanently, forever, you're covered by it. And he will have been treated as if he committed all of your past, present, and future sins. So while Jesus Christ was on the cross during the 3 hours of darkness, God the Father treated God the Son as if he had committed every single particular sin of everyone to that point who had believed in him. and everyone who will believe in him to the end of to the eternal state. He paid that. He was treated. He absorbed the punishment due for sins for people who would believe. And so if you do believe, if you receive Christ genuinely, then that's how salvation works. You are covered by his perfect life, and he drank the cup for every single sin you've ever committed, every single sin you ever will commit. That's why you cannot lose your salvation if you genuinely get converted. Because your hope is not in your own. If your hope is in your own, that means like, all right, I believe now. Now I got to obey God going forward in order to keep it, or you know, I can't fall away or whatever else. Well, then you're in trouble, because God's standard never changes. It's perfect righteousness. But the truth of the matter is, genuine conversion, every single time, you get applied the righteousness of Christ, and he drank all of the wrath for your sins. So there's no way you can lose your salvation, because the debt has been fully paid. All right. But if you refuse the offer of the gospel of Jesus Christ, you will be judged according to your works. And that'll happen at the white throne judgment. And unless you have sinned, lived without even one sin like Christ, that's rhetorical and laughable, will end in eternal conscious condemnation. So, again, you know, one of the surprising things when I talk to people about the gospel or interact with people about the gospel online is that you're surprised to find out that God's standard is perfect righteousness. Most people think, I understand you can't be evil. Can't be like Hitler. Can't be like a rapist. You can't be like a serial killer. You can't be like a... But you got to be good, right? But their standard of goodness is not the biblical standard. The standard of goodness biblically is perfect righteousness, absolutely sinless, thought, word, or deed. That should sober anybody. And anybody who claims that they have not sinned in thought, word, or deed is insane or just flat out self-deceived. Or just lying about it. They know they sin and they're lying about it. And I think that's probably the case. But there's the standard. Hence, you wouldn't flee to Christ if you thought, all right, the standard is a curve. I feel like I'm on the upper end of the curve, so I'm okay, I don't need Christ. But when you understand this, the standard is perfect holiness, and you genuinely come to that point in your heart, God grants that to you, then you flee to Christ as fast as you possibly can, because you recognize your own sinfulness. Not only is nobody good enough on a curve, nobody has any idea how sinful they truly are. Nobody does. That's why in Scripture, when you see people interact with God, they don't have a happy time in doing so. They hit the floor, and they're almost nauseous because of their sin. Because you interact with God and his holiness, it exposes your sinfulness. And so it's a traumatic thing to recognize your sin. And praise the Lord, I wouldn't want to know. I mean, it would be terrifying for him to expose me to my best day as a Christian, serving him as hard as I can, but still, I know my own heart. I know my struggles every day, and I would not even want to know. It keeps me humble to know that, Lord, be merciful to me, because I know if you took away your mercy and showed me my sin, oh, my goodness, it would be I would be humbled immediately. So I try and keep myself humble, because if I don't, I know that's coming. But the point is that as a lost person who's a lost person does anything but sin. And if they're exposed to that and they recognize that, it would be a beeline to Christ. All right. Well, like I said, I appreciate you tuning in for this podcast. And I can't say when or if there will be another one. The way things have been going, I plan on maybe in 2 weeks, maybe a month, doing another one, just seeing how it goes. I do start doing my lawn care now about this time of year, so I get a little busier, but we'll just kind of see how the world reacts. But like I said, in the meantime, I'm a Crosscut Maker. I'm all over social media, and there's all kinds of links to my website, some theology, end times, so there's all kinds of ways to visit my material in the meantime, because like I said, the podcast is kind of like one of the fewer things that I do now. But I appreciate you turning in. Until then, may Christ be glorified and known throughout the world.